This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. You're listening to the final minutes of one of the early successful works heard from my guest today as we conclude our chat with American composer Michael Torkey. That was the movement titled after something that has become virtually extinct today due to technology, the Yellow Pages, movement one from his work titled Telephone Book, performed by the ensemble Present Music. Michael Torkey was born in Milwaukee, and he charted his course in music through Eastman and Yale. As we heard last week, he gives much of the credit to his incredible first decades on the scene to those he studied with, learned from, or who gave him breaks that seemed too good to be true. Composer Jacob Druckman, David Del Tredici, Christopher Rouse, Joseph Schwantner, Lucas Foss, and a Decca executive who decided to dedicate a series of recordings on the Argo label solely to my guest's works. But it still came down to his music, which is instantly impactful, that can be attributed to his success in those first heady years. As the millennium approached, he found success and awards with his one-act opera Strawberry Fields. The Disney Corporation commissioned a huge work, and as the record business teetered, he was able to obtain the masters from those Decca Argo recordings and re-release them on his own label, Ecstatic Records, which continues today. He continues to compose for and be commissioned by top ensembles, orchestras, ballet companies, directors, and writers across this country and the globe. A veer towards vocal music seemed to many to take him off the radar scope for a while, but he's back and as busy and as focused as ever. Throughout his life, he has had synesthesia, which is reflected in a series of early works, all titled simply by colors. He now splits his time between New York City and Las Vegas. I caught up with him at his apartment in New York a few weeks back. Before we begin the conclusion of our chat, here's a movement from his cycle called Book of Proverbs. This movement titled Drink Our Fill of Love, the voice of Kurt Oldman, the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic Orchestra led by Ado de Waart.
And I saw among the simple ones, I observed among the young men, are you with no sense, going along the street, near the corner, then walking in the direction of her house, in the twilight, the dusk of day, at the time of the dark of I have spread my couch with brocaded cloths of Egyptian linen. I have sprinkled my bed with myrrh, with aloes, and with cinnamon. Come, let us drink our fill of love, a
So we've heard about all these people helping you in front of the scenes, behind the scenes. It still comes down to you writing the music. And I think what struck Mr. Carnell from Decca and all these people, I don't know a way to say this because I don't want to be too wonkish, but I don't want to be clumsy either. Your music has this directness to it. There's some of those early pieces, and people heard it, and they went, wow. And they may not have said anything after that. This is really, I really enjoyed that piece of music. When did you start to realize that you were writing music that had this really direct appeal for a lot of people, where even back then, and you know, the minimalist phase, if you want to call that, was ramping up with Glass and Reich, but you know, still new music was a kind of a boogie word for a lot of people, a boogie notion. And all of a sudden, you know, your music was instantly impacting them, and they liked to listen to it. I don't know if that's
I know what you mean, and I thought about it. It wasn't unconscious, it was conscious. You know, and again, it's maybe that Midwestern no-nonsense naivete that for most of the history of classical music, the greatest examples always just hit you in the face, whether it was the Bach B minor Mass, just, you know, going like that, or a Beethoven symphony, or a Tchaikovsky piece, you name it. It was always an arresting experience for a young person kind of making a foray into learning about classical music as a teenager. And so if we're now living in the age we're living in and we want to write our version of classical music, let's call it concert music, why would you give that up? And it seemed that the only influence of why people gave that up was modernism taught us to do that. We had to write this weird, complicated music that was so distanced from any kind of just direct human feeling. And it's a complicated reason why music went down those dark alleys, and that it may have attracted certain kinds of creative people that weren't, I don't know, very exciting human beings to begin with. You know, it could have brought all the kind of math nerds out who really weren't very musical because they could excel in 12-tone combinatoriality, for example. And maybe some of the real restless people went into popular music or into musical theater or into movie music. Maybe that's where the talent went. But I wasn't particularly interested in any of those areas. I like concert music. And so, well, why not? You know, I mean, and if everyone says, well, the music shouldn't be exciting and it shouldn't be fun and it shouldn't be direct, well, no one was going to tell me what to do. You know, that was the feel.
Well, I thought of a better way to frame that question. It's still awkward.
Oh, but so I'm not
answering. No, you are. But no, you helped me reframe it. There was a stretch, you know, when I don't know if many composers, upon hearing a work they did, someone came up to them and said, use the verb, I enjoyed that. And I'm serious about that. Oh. And yet I know people came up to you and said, I really enjoyed that piece. And I'm just wondering what that felt like to have people say, I enjoyed your music, because that wasn't a sentiment that a lot of composers heard. They might have heard, you know, that spoke to me and I understood, or, well, what a deep piece. But, you know, enjoy might not have been the first.
Yeah.
And not for those in the know, but just for a general music-going public that was listening to pieces.
But again, why is writing new music any different from doing new theater or writing a novel or doing a painting? And, you know, in the mid-80s, paintings had gotten... There was neo-expressionism, but there was also this kind of neo-pop art with artists like Kenny Scharf and... Who was the guy who did the subway art? Keith Haring. And Andy Warhol was leading the way. And so it wasn't like I'm sitting here in a vacuum thinking, everywhere around me, things were enjoyable, interesting, fun. And that the smartest people I knew were taking these enjoyable, interesting, and fun things and taking them seriously. So it was only musicians to say, oh, well, we're much deeper than that, you know, which is, of course, an excuse.
Yeah, I agree.
Branching out into music for wind ensemble, here's the University of Kansas Wind Ensemble, led by Paul Popiel, performing my guest Michael Torkey's Bliss.
mentioned One Piece, but I think people that know your music who don't know why, that there are an inordinate number of pieces with colors in them. And that's because, and I don't know how to phrase this, synesthesia. Are you a synesthesiac? I mean, what do you call somebody who has this? And just explain it and how it impacts your music and how it has, you know, just for those that don't really know about it.
In some deep part of the brain, you involuntarily mix up the senses. That's, I guess, what it is. And so the experience of color when I hear certain keys or pitches, and it's something ever since when I started at age 5, it was just something I thought everyone experienced. Yeah, right. And then I found out they didn't. So the idea in those color pieces from the 1980s wasn't so much to say, since I experienced D major as blue, I'm going to write a blue piece, which is kind of the most direct reason why that piece has that title. For me, it was wrestling with form. Once again, why does musical form always have to move away from something? Sonata form works that way, where you establish a room and you move out. That's like the development section, and coming back into the room is the recapitulation. If you're at a great party on Saturday night, why would you ever want to leave? That was my argument. And so I thought, if I could write a piece, a single movement where you just were in D major and never modulated out, you'd be saying something about form, and you'd be saying something about the key. And if the key is blue, well, then that would be a good title.
For those that don't know how this fires in your brain, are the same colors always associated with key centers? Yeah. It never changes.
Right.
Okay. And so therefore, some don't have an association?
Well, some are more vivid than others. Like E major is this bright green for me. Whereas E flat, I mean, this sounds logical, is like olive green. It's more, you know. Huh. And the key of F minor is kind of nebulous, but it's more kind of a brownish ashes. That's the name, ash.
Yeah, yeah.
That piece is in F minor. G major being yellow is pretty vivid, but people will say, well, what is C major? And that's almost the absence of color. It's just like this big white mass.
When you hear other people's music, it's the same. It doesn't matter that it's your music.
Right, no. And it doesn't have anything to do with the music.
Yeah.
And that's why people think I get music inspiration from this. No. If someone says, I get music inspiration from having perfect pitch, that's nonsense.
Right.
Perfect pitch is just a convenience. The synesthesia is just something that kind of happens. And people want to say, oh, then you must look at paintings and get musical ideas. No, it doesn't work the other way. And it's not as sentimental as it sounds.
But a number of these early pieces from the 80s and stuff did carry this. Does it impact you still today in your creative
process?
Well,
guess what? You know, we're all losing our facilities as we grow older. Oh. I'm losing my perfect pitch, I think.
Oh.
So I go and I hear an orchestra tune, and I'm saying, why is the oboe playing B flat? And then I realize, oh, I'm losing it. And so now that I can't hear in an absolute perfect way, and I don't think about it as much either, I feel I'm kind of losing that, but it's one of the most interviewed questions that I've ever gotten. And yet it feels that it's the least interesting thing that's going on. And I'm not putting you down. I'm not putting all of those people down.
It's such a thing that if you study music, you know Scriabin, and that's what you associate with this. And so it's just interesting. A lot of people may not even know it really exists, and if it does, how it works.
Yeah, and you know, science has attempted with fMRI, when they do the brain scans, they're finding out real scientific evidence. Oliver Sacks wrote a groundbreaking book called Musicophilia, and I'm in the chapter. Yeah. But as I said to Oliver Sacks when he interviewed me, I said, I wonder if it even exists, because it could be a hyper-strong association that I developed as a four-year-old. And I wonder whether I was playing on a toy piano where they had little circles and there was a blue on D major. And so when I played I thought, oh, this is the blue key. And then it just stuck with me. And that it has nothing to do with the brain. It's just my imagination having these kind of things. And he kind of shook his head. He didn't say no, but he didn't talk about it in his writing.
Yeah.
So
it's fascinating. I'm sure there's a number of people who bought the CDs, heard the pieces, and really never connected the dots, if you want to talk about connecting dots, of why you would name this 8.5-minute piece a color, you know? And there's so many great names, or even just, you know, anyway.
Last week, we played from one of my guests, Michael Torquay's color series, works being a synesthete, that he associates color with music keys, and music sounds. Here's another of those very successful works, his Bright Blue Music. David Zinman leads the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you.
Before we get to what you're doing today, one more thing about composers. Interviewed a number of composers in this program. There's composers of a certain set age, older than you, who tragically, not all of them, but some of them feel bitter. They feel time has passed them. Their music is not played. Their music is not appreciated. So you have that upper strata. You have a whole younger strata of composers, 40 and under, who mostly due to a lot of it due to technology and social media, are getting a lot of attention. And good for them. So they're sort of reveling in a massive amount of exposure when huge industries, which used to give exposure to composers, the recording industry, and even the concert world, you're kind of in the middle. I'm just wondering your thoughts on just the general of composer colleagues, be they younger than you or older than you, and where you fit. I mean, you know, that type of thing.
Well, yeah, because you're asking more than one question.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of them is like, because I remember being a student at Eastman and these visiting composers who were on the old side would come in and I would hear that bitterness. And I was thinking, how could anyone be bitter? There's some kind of tragic character flaw with that. You know, like, I don't play professional baseball. I can't throw a ball 98 miles an hour. Am I bitter about it? The only way I'd be bitter about it is if somehow I felt entitled that I should be the best pitcher in the world. But I'm not. And the fact that I'm not doesn't reduce the quality of my life. So it partly is that whatever gifts anyone is given comes from not our own doings, so then we can't really take this responsibility for it. Therefore, we can't feel bitter when something happens that we think should. And this idea of entitlement. The other thing is what Warren Buffett talks about is the inner scorecard and our scorecard is our self-worth based on how other people approve or disapprove us. Or is it our own goals that we have fulfilled? So if you really go by the inner scorecard, how can you be bitter? I think every day I could wake up and my music would never be played again because it's all so subjective. Well, I had a good run. I mean, that's you know, I mean, what are you going to do? It just seems like that is a kind of an emotion that really is just so... The only person who suffers is the bitteree. It's the guy who's feeling bitter. Because no one else cares. If so-and-so's music isn't being played, we're not sitting there moaning. And if we do feel there's a great injustice, we organize concerts and we play that person's music, you know? And I don't know. That just seems ridiculous. So that's about bitterness. The younger generation, if it is true that they are getting a lot more attention from social media, but I wonder, because I've heard young people say, you know, like, well, what do I do? What's the next step? So I have all these followers on social media, but no one's taking me seriously like some influential composer. How do I do that? And so the idea that culture takes us seriously or thinks we're influential is something that would elude everyone. I think it would be harder today because we live in such a fractured, disparate world.
I agree with you, except what they have, if they're using it right, is, and you can have the same thing, anybody can, they can have a performance of a work or even them talking about the music, mm-hmm. and they can put it up on platforms like a YouTube or something like that, and who knows, hundreds of thousands of people could view this more than they could ever pack into a concert hall. Maybe they would certainly outdistance CD sales if they produced a CD. I'm just saying there's an opportunity there.
I think that that's great, but that's like being a pretty girl. Before there was the internet, you could walk down the street and people would whistle. But now you can put your stuff on Facebook and have millions of followers, but you're competing with all the other. In fact, you have even less of a kind of specialness now. So I think it's all kind of relative. And even if you do have a million followers of your new piece, which is very gratifying, I'm sure, I don't know whether that means that a commission is forthcoming or that any conductor is going to be interested or a soloist is going to take up your concerto or anything. Or that 5 years from now, even anyone will remember you.
Well, you give an interesting perspective because you had this incredible success before you were even 30 at a time when the old mechanisms were what was driving it.
And certainly were.
And now it's a completely different ballfield. Right. It really is, as far as what a composer...
I really wonder whether I've made some big mistakes in the past 10 years of not harnessing social media and not doing the things that a lot of superstars are doing. And my reasons for not doing that, my distrust of social media, might be wrong and misguided. So who knows? But I don't know. I'm not going to lose too much sleep over it, you know.
My guest Michael Tarquille has had success in addition to the orchestra stage, here from a ballet written for the Ballet of Canada called An Italian Straw Hat, a farce set in Belle Époque Paris, the two movements titled Top of the Eiffel Tower and the Pas de Deux of Ferdinand and Hélène. Ormsby Wilkins leads the National Ballet of Canada Orchestra.
So what, I mean, some composers are superstitious. What are you working on? Tease us a bit. What are you working on? Yeah. What's coming up?
Yeah, what's on my mind right now? I wrote a piece for the Philadelphia Orchestra for the 50th anniversary of SPAC last summer, a piece called Unconquered, and we're still working out the details of getting this professionally recorded. And that's a kind of a long haul. Well, I have a patron who really wants to... Well, here's something interesting. When everyone says no in classical music, they always say it's because we don't have the money. So I found when you have a rich guy saying, I'll write a check for any amount, that's and they say, and they're like, well, we have to think about it. Well, and then we bring this orchestra in over here and we play them off of that orchestra over there. I realize, it isn't the money. That was a real eye-opener. So that's on my mind. I have a piece that will be, well, just going forward. In February, I had a violin and piano piece that was commissioned by Carnegie Hall, played by this wonderful... No, you weren't there. I met you at Carnegie a week, month later. Yeah. So that was in early February. Tessa Lark, she won the Avery Fisher Award, and she premiered it. And in fact, on Wednesday of this week, we're going into the studio to record it for my label. And that went really well. And then a month later... These three woodwind concertos, one written for bassoon, one written for oboe, one written for flute, were premiered and recorded in Albany. And so now I'm thinking about what else might go on that album, because it's only half of an album. And I'm thinking about maybe writing a violin concerto for Tessa, because she's so enthusiastic and so talented. So we might put a project together with that. I am working on a chorus and orchestra commission right now. I can't speak too much about that. And the big thing is, after working with, and I will talk about this, after working with a collaborative team back in the late aughts of director Des Makinoff of Jersey Boys fame and Michael Corey, the librettist, who right now has a hit show on Broadway called War Paint, we were writing an opera on the Brazilian Formula One racing legend Ayrton Senna about the last 3 days, tragic days of his life. And... we worked together, we got a lot of it done, and the project, for various complicated reasons, kind of fell apart. It was on hiatus for 5 years. We've since reformed, and we are now, I guess I can't really talk about this, but there's a major operating company here in this country, and a sort of major one in Europe, and a huge, huge, huge star who... would be involved with the ultimate world premiere of this, which is now slated for 2020.
Wow.
And so we have been meeting and talking about that, and that would kind of revitalize the lost decade when I did all these theatrical and vocal things, that this would kind of bring that around. So I'm very excited about that.
It's still stunning, the time arc that opera works on.
There are many reasons why that's true.
Yes, but... I know. It's just so amazing.
Yeah, you work your whole life on one opera.
Well, we'll look forward to a lot of that happening. Yes. And of course, what's great is, like we talked about earlier, the pieces you compose, it's your label. You can put it out, and they're going to be available, and people can hear them and all the rest of that. So that's very cool. Continued success.
Thank you.
I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. And the first question...
It's like James Lipton's The Actor's Studio.
Yeah, I get it. First is hypothetical, which simply says, if you could chat like we've been doing, but with someone. When I asked that, first name that popped in your head, don't think about it long. You
get started.
Someone you never had a chance to talk to but could.
Well, two names came right up. Okay. Gershwin and Tchaikovsky. Because I guess why... I mean, I'm not really answering your question, but those were two tragic cases of geniuses who died too young.
Yeah.
And if they were alive... Of course, there's Mozart. But they're more towards our time, especially like with Gershwin. I would just love to hang out, have him play the piano, talk about music and all that. I think that would be the coolest thing. And Tchaikovsky, one of my big heroes, I think he was a super, super smart guy, probably even like a philosopher, and misunderstood by the 20th century, I think, as being this romantic composer. I don't think he is at all.
Yeah.
But maybe that's my wishful thinking, that somehow I could keep them alive. I can't do that. I wish they had written more music. Oh. Ravel is another one. He did live longer, but he didn't write enough music. I just, if we could have four more Ravel pieces. My life would be so much richer.
Yeah, the what ifs. I always put Gershwin and Schubert in the what ifs because I think
Schubert
would have happened.
Yeah.
I mean, Gershwin would have gone into film music and big time.
And he would have written more concert music too.
Yeah, he would.
No doubt.
Yeah, and he would have been interested. He might have turned tides on certain things.
Oh, the whole 20th century would have changed if he had stayed alive, at least in American music.
Final question is a non-musical question, which means everybody I interview, Cadenza fills their life with music. You're extremely busy, obviously. When you have to do something non-musical, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, it can act as a respite, pull yourself away when you need to get away. What do you do?
Yeah, well, I guess maybe, without thinking it too hard, it's like in the dead of winter to fly down to some tropical island, there's nothing, or to the south of Mexico where our family used to rent out this villa, there's just nothing better than getting off that plane and smelling that humidity, and it's 85 degrees when, it's 5 below zero here in New York. That's one of the most pleasurable things of all. But getting a little closer to home, I realized after all these years of thinking that my two favorite things to do in the world is have some good food in front of me and read a book. And doing those two together, there is nothing better than that. That is my favorite thing of all time.
Well, go back to your first thing. You get to leave New York and step off the plane in Las Vegas. I mean, this is this is a hardship.
That's right. Las Vegas is a little different. It's not tropical.
That's true.
It is a desert, and the winters do get colder than it should. It's not like Los Angeles or Palm Springs where it's always warm. And I love the dry air. When we used to go down to Huatulco in Mexico, that humidity of the ocean, I love that.
Well, thanks for taking the time, Michael Torkey. Thanks.
Composer Michael Torkey. You can find out more about him at his website, michaeltorkey.com. You can also order any recordings of his works on his Ecstatic Records label there. All of the performances we heard today are on the Ecstatic label, and I'll leave you with the closing minutes of a work about one of those warm places my guest would love to be. It is simply titled Fiji. The 10-10 Ensemble of the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic is led by Clark Rundell. Music of my guest today, Michael Torkey. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.